So Saturday night at Abayagiri, I have a number of people away at various functions, different things happening. Part of the community in residence is on forest practice, so basing their time and practice up in the forest at their cabins, out doing things in more solitude. So kind of a light crew here tonight, and also just coinciding with a number of guests who had been here for a period of time, coincidentally departing on the same day. So we actually don't have any overnight guests, just the residents of the community here. Gives us an opportunity for slowing down, reflecting, moving back inwards after a period of quite a bit of activity in the past couple of months. So a really good opportunity for us to settle back, move into more of a contemplative space, continue with our daily routines of engagement and activity and service, and also start turning the attention inwards more. Thinking along the lines of some of the ways we approach Dhamma practice and the ways coinciding really in a way in the ways that people engage in the world, and watching the process of how we engage and how we bring the practice into our lives and how people live their lives in a similar way. We often, you know, people in the world, the general way the world operates is through following this desire for happiness, seeking it in ways that are fairly well understood to give a sense of gratification, satisfaction in pursuits through the experiences of the senses, enjoying the pleasurable experiences that we can through sights and sounds and tastes and sensations, etc. Often living on a fairly surface level, getting some experience of happiness, but not taking it very deep, going from one to another to another. And it's driven by this process of conceptualizing, of thinking what it is that I can do, what it is that I can get to bring about this sense of pleasure, sense of happiness. And it all formulates itself in a very conceptual way, an idea that somehow this will be something that will bring me some gratification and happiness, and then we pursue it and we get it, and then we move on to the next thing to do the same, get the same sense of satisfaction and happiness, but with a slightly different approach. And we strategize and we plan our lives and our associations with people and our work and the ways that we structure time in our lives around this conceptualized idea of what it will bring to us. So that's the way basically the world functions, and it repeats itself over and over and over again. And it's not at all difficult to do that with spiritual practice as well. We come looking for a bit more of a stable sense of something that will bring us contentment, happiness, into an exploration of spiritual life. And we study things, we read things, we talk with people, and we start to develop an understanding of a spiritual path or a tradition, including the one that we're engaged in right here. And it's so easy to get caught in the ideas of the spiritual practice, the teachings, the conceptualization of the practice, and to get some happiness from thinking about it in those lines, along those lines. And the conceptualization, the intellectual process of learning the teachings, learning the different techniques that spiritual masters, spiritual teachers teach, and considering them, reading more, getting to know the suttas, gaining a lot of inspiration and benefit from them. And that's all skillful means, good stuff to do. But if we leave it at that level, then it's like we never taste the fruit. We get to know what its color is. We get to know what its odor is. We can see the texture of it and feel it and cut it up and examine it on the inside. But if we don't actually, this is a simile that Ajahn Chah often used, if we don't actually take it in and bring it into our bodies, we don't experience the taste. It's all more of a mental process, a conceptualization process. And we don't experience the actual taste of the fruit. Same true with our spiritual practice. It needs to be brought in and experienced, opanayiko, to be brought in or to leading inwards, as is in our chanting. Otherwise, we just continue to live in the world of ideas, which can then turn into ideals. We have an idea of what might bring us happiness, and then we develop certain ideals, say, around our spiritual practice of the best way to do something, the best lifestyle to have, the best structure for contemplation, and it's all developed on this level of ideals, and we structure our lives around enacting those ideals, again, on a conceptual level, and then even they turn into ideologies. We think a certain religion is better in some sort of conceived way, or some sort of subsection of a religion. The Thai forest tradition is the best. Those kinds of ideologies that we can get wrapped into and start to defend. And this happens the world over with different politics, religions, social structures. It all goes from certain ideas of what's good, developing ideals as to how to enact them, and developing social structures, political structures, religious structures as ideologies. And it can lead to even wars based on these kinds of ideologies. As Buddhists, we like to think we're exempt from that possibility. It's a very peaceful religion, very harm reduction religion, but you don't have to look too far in some countries and find that some Buddhists, people who call themselves Buddhists, are engaged in the same kind of thing, divisiveness and conflict and even sometimes violence. So if we leave it all on the level of conceptualization, ideas, ideals, etc., then we're never actually realizing the benefit of what the Buddha intended us to experience. So the way we do that is to use the intellect as we need to understand on a certain level the teachings and where they point and how to experience them. But then we really need to move deeper down below the level of abstraction and ideals, and opinions about what's the best thing to do, the strongest austerities or in a more open, relaxed allowance, finding the balance for ourselves, but keeping an eye on the effect of them in on the deeper levels of affective experience. And it kind of points to the two aspects of mind are talked about. There's two words in the Buddhist tradition, or at least in the Pali tradition, that are both of them are often translated as mind, although they're actually quite different experiences. We've got manas, which is more of the organizing, conceptualizing, categorizing, functional state of mental activity. Sometimes I think Ajahn Jeff uses the word intellect, which I feel is more descriptive of the actual process of manas, that kind of ability to deal with information and ideas, very useful function, but we get absorbed into it and think it's the be-all and the end-all, but it's a tool that we can use to help us understand things on a conceptual level with the goal of bringing it into the deeper level of mind, the other word, citta, often translated as heart as well as mind, or sometimes a combination of heart-mind, but referring more to the affective tone, the where we experience suffering, where we experience the end of suffering, peace, how we experience many of these qualities that support us on the path, all the different sublime states of mind and skillful mental states, patience and generosity and kindness and those kinds of qualities that lead us in the correct direction towards freedom, the goal being freedom, complete freedom from suffering. Citta is what is liberated. The five khandhas, including manas, the mental activities, which include mind as well as body. That's not what's liberated. Our personality isn't liberated. Those are fabricated causes and conditions that we're experiencing all the time, but it's that level of heart that experiences dukkha and knows the ending of it. This is where liberation takes place. So on the way to doing that, we have to fabricate and create certain qualities that lead us in that direction. Process of fabrication, creation of certain mental qualities that lead to the final release from all conditions, and leads to the unconditioned. And this is developing what we would call the kusala citta, the wholesome citta, the citta, the heart, the mind that is still dwelling within the realm of creations and fabrications, but actively and engaging in reflections and activities that lead in a wholesome direction. A wholesome direction meaning that which leads eventually to the end of suffering. Kusala citta. So there's a number of ways, a number of contemplations and ways of developing that. The bases for kusala citta can be sometimes described in practices, if you will, of dana sila bhavana, which is generosity, virtue, and mental cultivation, mental development. the sila, virtue, and dana, the development of generosity is something that we practice with every day on a daily basis here in the monastery. Having this basis of non-harming behavior in speech and bodily activities, and the attitude of giving, which operates at many different levels, giving materially, if one so desires, giving in terms of time and energy, commitment to the community, service, and just giving up notions of any kind of selfishness, trying to always expand outwards rather than take inwards in terms of what we get from our environment, what we get from other people's, kind of an economics of generosity helps to develop this kusala citta, this wholesome heart. So we do that with our sila, with our practice of generosity, giving. And then pretty much everything else can fall into that category of bhavana, mental cultivation, all the other skillful qualities that we can bring in, recognize, explore, contemplate, and encourage in ourselves. Many different techniques, reflections, ways of meditation to bring in that mental cultivation aspect. And one of the ones that I find over and over again very useful to bring into awareness are the cultivation of the Brahma Viharas, the four divine abidings, sublime abidings, sometimes called. Most of you are familiar with that, that set of four qualities of what we would call the abiding place of the gods, or the highest experiences of mental conditions that can exist, the most wholesome, along the lines of the most wholesome dwelling places that we have in the realm of the fabricated. Metta, karuna, mudita, upeka, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And we've all probably heard teachings from many different skilled teachers describing methods to develop those states of mind and what to do with them and how to use them. And I think this evening, just to mention maybe a few alternative ways of approaching that, the traditional ways based in the commentaries talk a lot about methodologies of developing a certain reflection, certain ways of bringing it to mind, techniques to develop it and expand it into their boundless qualities. Those can be useful, but when you, at least when I explore the suttas, find the more of the majority of the descriptions are more of the qualities that result when one does develop these, when one does experience them. Very experiential references to them that point to what is it actually like? What are these states of mind like? And in the traditional approach that's often taught, based on commentaries, again, one develops these qualities and then it broadcasts them into widening circles of sentient beings, starting with oneself, moving to people that one feels comfortable with, connection with, has a good relationship with, more neutral people who then to whom you actually feel aversion towards, and then groups of people expanding, gradually expanding into all beings, and sending those energies outwards to all beings. technique that's also been explained and taught that I find I resonate with is more reflecting on and experiencing these qualities of mind, always keeping a center of awareness of the experience that one is having with them, developing that quality, allowing that quality to grow and expand, but not broadcasting it out, not but inviting more in a way other beings into that experience that you're holding a very strong center with, so that you're never losing your groundedness, often to be experienced in the bodily experience. You're staying with the body and with an expanding awareness beyond that that gradually grows, but you're not projecting it outwards. You're always keeping it close to home and expanding one's boundaries and capacity to be able to hold, invite, in a sense, all other beings into that. That way it stays grounded within your own experience. At the same time, it can be shared with others that are moving into that space as you create it more in larger and larger ways. So, you know, starting with the quality of metta, often translated as loving kindness, the Buddha says that when that's fully developed to its very boundless quality, it results in an experience of what he calls the beautiful. And the level of consciousness that can be experienced with that can be very, very expansive into this dwelling place, if you will, this Brahma Vihara of the beautiful. It's not super well described in the teachings that I know of, anyway, along those lines. But if one develops that quality of kindness and metta through whatever reflection or association you find useful, and not to go into a lot of detail about methodology tonight, but in whatever ways you find to develop that, allowing it to expand into this experience of sublime beauty. And when you think of the word beautiful, oftentimes we think of it in terms of sensory experience, like a beautiful sight, someone who has a beautiful appearance, or beautiful sounds like incredibly moving music, sensations of different kinds, all of the experiences that one can have through the sense bases, physical sense bases. But this isn't what this kind of beautiful is referring to. This is a sense of beauty and awe that is a very expansive level of awareness experienced through this very unlimited, well-wishing sense of appreciation for other beings who are experiencing or being generous or helpful, your own ability to be non-judgmental, to be free of ill will and hostility. And you can experience that as when you are able to bring that up as a dwelling place, even if it's not super expansive yet, the sense of rapture, in a sense, that comes from that, rapture being a very sublime sense of beauty. And the sense of well-being, intense well-being, that comes from that. And then just to be able to dwell there and hold that with clarity and awareness of what it is, and to allow that sublime feeling of beauty just pervade one's own awareness, and then gradually bring other beings into that. in one's imagination. And to just firmly establish that as a place of dwelling, a vihara. And it's just an incredible experience to the extent that one can experience it. I would like to say I've, developed it to a completely boundless state. I'm not there yet, but you can get hints of it. All of us can get hints of it by bringing it to mind, bringing it into our practice. So to dwell in that dwelling place of the beautiful. The Brahma Vihara of compassion, to me, has a connotation of space, spaciousness, because the traditional definition of being wishing for all beings, including ourselves, to be free from suffering. So in the face of pain, difficulty, intense, difficult situations, the quality of compassion is how we face that, whether it's ourselves, other beings. It's all the same. And it's the way that we do that is by allowing ourselves to hold the experience of dukkha, hold the experience of suffering without pushing it away, without moving into aversion, wishing things weren't the way they are in these difficult circumstances, and to be able, without indulging, to be able to fully understand, fully experience this inevitable pain that comes with living as a human being. There's some kinds of pain that we just can't avoid. It's built into the system. And when we experience that, developing this overall, overarching ability to hold it in a way that is not tight and constricted and trying to run away from or trying to get rid of it, but holding it with gradually expanding levels of spaciousness. And if we can do that for ourselves, we can do that much easier for other people too. Sometimes the best gift you give to somebody who's going through intense suffering, rather than trying to come up with ideas or suggestions of how they can, how you can help them, to just hold the space, be there as a witness, whether it's your own or whether somebody else's, establishing that space of being the witness. And that allows people and ourselves the safety of kind of a non-judgmental way of being able to see it and hold it and let the fear of the pain move through. And we see that we can actually survive and hold things that are difficult if we give it enough space, and rather than constricting around it, which makes the experience of the dukkha, the painfulness, all the more intense. The less space we have for it, the more that it occupies what space there is. So if we can expand that space of holding it and being aware of it, then its impact is not so great. It's still there, still present, but is held in a lot of openness, boundlessness that can deal with it. We can hold more often. We can hold more than we think we can. So, developing that sense of infinite space to hold compassion, to hold the dukkha that we hear about and experience ourselves so much. The third Brahma Vihara, mudita, sympathetic joy, often defined as the appreciation of others' success or happiness, a fairly rare commodity in the world. Rather than contracting in our usual way around seeing someone have something that we want, and that we appreciate their success, the praise or the good reputation that they have, the praise that they get, how easy it is to, if we're feeling a bit bereft of those experiences, how easy it is to, you know, quietly wish, well, nice for them, but what about me? You know, I would like some of that too. And it's a form of aversion, this kind of envy, if you will, jealousy. And how unpleasant that is. And if we can cultivate this sense of sympathetic joy, joy in the success of others, then we don't have to be that contracted. We can also start to expand into that more pleasant experience. And in a way, it's the beginning of the dissolution of that self and other way that we experience the world. Somebody's got something that we don't have is a very self and other kind of experience. And if we can develop that sense of appreciation for what other people have, then the sense of me who doesn't have something in relation to somebody who else who does have something starts to dissolve. And we can then allow ourselves to reflect, okay, well, what is that? That experience that person is having is something that I probably have experienced before, and can rejoice in that feeling and remember that feeling when I've had it, realize that they've got it now, and it's the same feeling. It's nothing that needs to cause me to feel separate from them, and not to be able to share in that quality with them. So this sense of joy at the fact that there is something good happening in somebody's life, and that it's the same goodness that I feel when it happens with me. And to recollect that and to bring that into the heart and let that sense of unity with another person's experience rise up, so that it's moving into this sense of less of a designation of self and other and more of a designation of unity of experience. You know, at its greatest level, it can be developed into this unlimited level of consciousness, the beginning, as I was saying, of the dissolution of self and other, this unified consciousness experience. When it's fully developed and absorbed into, it can be described as a vihara of unlimited consciousness. And the fourth quality of equanimity, upeka, of that ability to be even and aware of the normal tendencies that we have to go for pleasure, try to avoid pain. When pleasurable things happen, we try to obtain, to get, the mind moves towards something, even if it's a subtle movement towards a pleasurable experience, even a very sublime, pleasurable feeling of meditation experiences. If we move towards that or move away from the unpleasant experiences that come through the sense bases or through our mental activities, then we've lost our equanimity. But that evenness of mind and the recognition of the stable, unmoving mind, either towards or away from, or the mind that's thrown off by confusion and delusion, the wisdom aspect of our abilities, of our mental abilities, comes to the fore, and we realize that we don't have to allow the mind to move in those ways. It can have a very stable presence of mind in whatever pleasurable experiences, whatever painful experiences, neutral experiences arise. And with that we're developing this sense of non-clinging. Someone asked Ajahn Buddhadasa sort of what in one phrase could he describe the practice, and it's basically not clinging to anything whatsoever, this quality of not holding, of non-attachment, and it's not a complete divorce of experience from all of these things, but an experiencing with wisdom so that we aren't grasping at that which is pleasurable, grasping at the thought of getting rid of everything else that's painful. But this non-clinging that is the root of not forming any kind of identity around anything, not forming attachment to experiences, however, whatever their affective tone is, not creating the world around us, trying to define it in a way that produces a sense of stability in a very unstable world. So this quality of non-clinging, it's dwelling at the level of experience rather than objects. It's losing the objectification tendencies that we have, letting go of those tendencies to objectify everything. In a sense, it's developing that quality or that dwelling place of what sometimes is pronounced as nothingness, but is really more like no-thingness. It's not a complete dissolution of all experience into a void of nothing, but it's taking the thingness out of our experience so that we don't experience the world around us in terms of objects, but more in terms of the flow of rapidly changing, consistently changing levels of experience. This is the way of contemplating the world in our tradition. So no thingness through non-clinging. And this is the full development of the Brahma-vihara of equanimity. And it's still part of the realm of fabrications, but if we can develop that as a launching pad so that we're not even attached to this very sublime bliss and pleasure of the feeling of the fabricated equanimity, but we're able to actually be equanimous to that as well and let go, constant process of letting go of all attachment, of all clinging, then that can be a wonderful launching pad to move into the experience of the unfabricated, that which is completely apart from even the most sublime, beautiful creations like the Brahma-viharas. So rather than, again, just looking at the Brahma-viharas as techniques of contemplation, we bring in some of these descriptors of the results of dwelling in these sublime states of mind and figuring out our own ways of reflections that help to bring those about. But sometimes even just the remembering these descriptive qualities, going through them, reviewing them, well, what might that be like? What might that be like to dwell unwaveringly in the experience of the beautiful or of spaciousness or of that kind of sense of non-identification, non-separation of self and other, selflessness, unity, or in that quality of evenness of mind that doesn't go out and fabricate an external identity, reality, and doesn't cling, doesn't hold to experience as it arises, as it passes away, lets it go as it is arising and passing away. So just contemplating what might that feel like, and dwelling with that, letting that develop, grow, blossom through constant and refreshment as needed, and allowing oneself to just sink into these experiences for as long as they will last, and then letting them go, realizing that they're fabricated, require certain things to keep them going, and when that runs out, then they too have their own life. It might be a very long one, but they'll fade out because they're still part of the conditioned realm. And the final liberation isn't until we let go of all of these things. So I'll leave it there for reflection this evening.